You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, some surprising facts and unanswered questions about allergies.
First, we're getting the latest news out of the Supreme Court. The court is racing to issue opinions in several cases before the end of the month, and this morning they announced a handful of decisions.
Adam Liptak is here to fill us in. He's the Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start with an announcement about a case out of Wisconsin. The Supreme Court announced that it will not take up a case about a public school graduation in an evangelical church here in the state. What does the decision mean?
It was a bit of a surprise because the court has this term indicated a receptiveness to some role for religion in public life, ruling that town board meetings can start with a prayer. And you might have thought that they'd take a case on whether a high school graduation can take place in a church with lots of religious Christian symbolism. But the court turned it down over a dissent from two justices, Justices Scalia and Justice Thomas, who said they should have taken it or, at a minimum, sent the case back to the lower courts for reconsideration in light of the legislative town hall prayer meeting per case.
Right. And as you say, it seemed as though this Wisconsin case could have allowed the justices to extend that decision you were talking about to public schools, but they did the reverse. Why, in effect, did they draw the line there?
My best guess is that Justice Kennedy, the swing vote, thinks that government-sanctioned religious displays are more okay when children are not involved. That is, when you have students going to a place where they're compelled to go and want to go for their graduations, the fact that they're minors makes a difference to them, and that probably means that neither side was sure they had his vote, and therefore they'd rather kick the can down the road.
And what do you think the decision says about the issue of separation of church and state looking forward?
Well, when the court turns down a case, which it does 99% of the time, they make a point of saying it doesn't establish a precedent, it doesn't disclose a point of view. So I wouldn't read very much into the fact that they turned this down. But I do think we saw in the town board meeting case, and are likely to see in a case in the next couple of weeks about religious companies' objections to this, the so-called contraception mandate, that this is a court where there's a receptiveness to some religion in government settings.
Well, let's move on to another fairly big decision here. The Supreme Court ruled against the gun lobby in a decision that gun buyers have to report when they're buying a gun for somebody else. How did that decision unfold?
Well, on the one hand, it seems fairly straightforward. A federal law says that you have to say if you're buying on behalf of someone else, and this person did not say, and was convicted of failing to disclose that he was a so-called straw buyer, and was sentenced to 5 years probation. What was a little bit surprising is that this statutory interpretation case divided 5-4 along the classic lines of Kennedy plus the four more liberal justices in the majority and the four more conservative justices in dissent. You see that more often in big controversial constitutional cases, where it's just a matter of interpreting the words of a statute. You don't see as many of these kinds of 5-4s.
And this was the second of two decisions going against the gun lobby. Does that signify anything?
I wouldn't be so quick to characterize it as a pro versus con gun lobby case. I would say that the court, ever since it established an individual right to bear arms under the Second Amendment in 2008, has almost entirely stayed out of the question. So it's basically let federal and state governments continue to impose gun regulations. So the early message of that big Second Amendment case in 2008 seems not to have been followed through on.
And Judge Scalia issuing a pretty scathing dissension on this one. What do you know about what he said?
Justice Scalia said that at least when the person actually going to the counter to buy the gun is buying it for someone who's also eligible to have a gun, whether you make the disclosure or not is completely immaterial. By Scalia standards, it wasn't so scathing, but he did think the majority opinion by Justice Kagan was quite wrong.
Well, there's another one which has had some twists and turns, a major victory for the group Susan B. Anthony List. And the court has approved their lawsuit, that it can go forward. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, Ohio has a law, and so do 15 other states, that makes it a crime, this will surprise you, makes it a crime to lie in a political campaign. And Susan B. Anthony List wanted to challenge that law. It had tried to put up a billboard saying that an incumbent congressman's vote for the Affordable Care Act was a vote for taxpayer-funded abortion. That's not clear that that's a true statement. And the Ohio Elections Commission said there was probable cause to think they'd commit a crime when by putting up that billboard. And they wanted to sue over the law and ask the question of, does the First Amendment allow the government to stop people from speaking in a political campaign? And the only question for the court was not the more interesting question of, is this law constitutional, but the threshold question of, had this group suffered a direct enough, imminent enough injury to be allowed to sue? And the court unanimously said yes. If nothing else, they can sue, and we'll decide later whether the law is constitutional.
So what happens next?
It goes back to the lower courts, and there's likely to be a trial.
And do you think it's likely to get kicked back upstairs to the Supreme Court?
I think it depends how it comes out. I think this is a court, judging by its earlier decisions, that is not comfortable with laws that make it a crime to speak in a political campaign. So if the lower court were to strike down the law, I don't know that it goes back to the Supreme Court. If the lower court says that law is fine, the Supreme Court's quite likely to intercede.
How important do you think that this particular case is?
Oh, I think it's the particular case, you know, maybe not so much. The general issue of how much the government can regulate speech in a political setting is very important and goes to the core of the First Amendment and is not wholly unrelated to cases like Citizens United, which also rely on the First Amendment to characterize corporate expenditures as political speech. So it fits into the court's jurisprudence more generally.
And the court has announced that it's going to turn away from an appeal in Argentina. The nation tried to appeal a decision requiring it to pay holders of bonds on which it had defaulted. Give us a little bit of the backstory there.
Yes, so this is a financially very important case. Argentina defaulted in 2001 on billions of dollars of debt. And 92% of the people the people who held those bonds agreed to take an enormous haircut, to take 20 or 25 cents on the dollar. But a few people didn't. And they sued, and they said Argentina was not entitled to force them into that kind of restructuring. And the lower courts in New York agreed, and the Supreme Court, by not agreeing to hear the case today, now has put Argentina to what will be a very difficult choice for it, of whether to default yet again or to pay out these holdout bondholders probably $15 billion, which is an enormous shock to that economy.
Well, looking ahead, the court has a lot of work ahead of it in just the next couple of weeks. One of the biggest cases still on the table is the so-called Hobby Lobby case, the craft giant challenging government-mandated birth control. What are you expecting there?
I think more likely than not, the court says two things. First of all, that at least some closely held corporations that say they want to operate on a religious basis do have religious liberty rights. And then it probably goes on to say, I would guess by a 5-4 majority, that those rights were violated by a law that would force companies to provide contraceptive coverage to women, where those companies contend that at least some of the drugs and devices involved are tantamount to abortion. That's speculation, of course. We'll find out in the next couple of weeks. But they have a lot of big cases yet to come in the next 2 weeks.
And just in our last minute here, there's a slew of other things. I think it's fair to call it a slew. What's sticking up on your radars as some of the biggest things they have to decide?
Oh, I like the case about protest zones around abortion clinics, about whether the police can search your cell phone if they arrest you, about recess appointments, about a service called Aereo that streams broadcast television over the Internet, one about greenhouse gases. Today wasn't such a big day at the court, but the next few days of decisions are going to be big ones.
Great. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us and getting us up to speed.
Thanks for having me.
That was Adam Liptak, Supreme Court reporter for The New York Times. Seasonal allergy sufferers are feeling the sneeze and the wheeze lately, but what's the science behind those allergies?
Our next guest is a science writer who looked into some of the latest research. Maggie Kurth-Baker joins us. She's science editor at boingboing.net. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're based in the Midwest. How are your allergies, if any, so far this year?
Mine are okay. My baby daughter has had a runny nose for the last couple of months, but otherwise I think we're doing pretty good.
Yeah, I've been on and off fine and then bursts of sudden sneezing for no apparent reason. Well, let's get into that runny nose you mentioned. If my nose is running during allergy season, what am I getting out of it? What's the function of the runny nose?
Well, the interesting thing is that we don't really know what the function of the runny nose is. You know, there's been some speculation in the past that having your nose run could be your body's way of trying to sort of flush invaders out of your nose. But that doesn't totally match up with the data. And so researchers are sort of left thinking that we don't necessarily even have a reason why your nose runs, that could just be a side effect of this process that happens when you get something into your body that your body thinks shouldn't be there, even when it doesn't really matter, which is the case with pollen.
Yeah, I always assume that this is a way of ejecting the stuff that's annoying us, but apparently maybe not.
No, yeah. I mean, for one thing, pollen shouldn't even be something that annoys your body. It's not something that's a threat. It's not something that's really particularly dangerous. And having your nose running doesn't necessarily do the job of, like, you know, getting the pollen out of your nose. So it could just be a side effect of what happens once this whole immune system response gets going. You end up with a domino effect that leads to a runny nose, even though the runny nose doesn't help you in any way.
That's one of the most annoying side effects, and it's doing nothing. I find that kind of annoying, actually. Who do I complain to about that? Well, and then speaking of weird allergy things, when we meet an allergen for the first time, like if I'm going to be allergic to a particular kind of pollen, say, am I going to react to it the first time I run across it?
No, actually. So the way that the whole system works is that your body has to encounter the allergen first. And that first time that it encounters the allergen, it starts making this stuff called immunoglobulin E, which are these little receptors that the next time you encounter that allergen, they will then tell these cells called mast cells that are filled with histamine, which is the stuff that you've heard about with antihistamine medication. Mm-hmm. It tells these mast cells to release all this histamine into your body, and it's the histamine that causes the symptoms that we think of when we think of allergies. But that process doesn't happen the first time. Like I say, you have to have your body has to encounter the allergen once, then have the time to make all of this immunoglobulin, and then the next time you encounter it, if you've got enough immunoglobulin, then the actual process starts. So the process of going through and making that immunoglobulin can take 4 to 6 weeks. So depending on the kind of allergy you're talking about, it might be something where you move to a new place and you encounter pollen and you don't have an allergy until the next spring, because the first spring your body was just in the process of preparing to have allergies the next time.
So it can trick you. I might think, my spring allergies are gone in this new place. How happy. And then not learn the truth until a year later.
Right, exactly.
So when it's doing that, that first encounter, the die is already cast, right? Your body knows it's going to start getting ready to react to it. It's not meeting in committee for 4 to 6 weeks deciding whether you're allergic.
No, it's not. It's not deciding whether you're allergic. It's in the process of making the immunoglobulin that is going to launch that allergic reaction the next time.
Now, it seems like I hear about more people getting allergic, and that just could be who I know or where I live or something like that. Are diagnosed allergies getting more common?
They are, actually. 50% of the population is now allergic to at least one thing in the United States, and we don't really know exactly why that is. You know, there's this idea that you've probably heard of called the hygiene hypothesis, which is basically this idea that, you know, we've gotten these much cleaner, much more sanitary lives in the past 100 years or so. And maybe if you have a life that's too clean and too sanitary when you're a small child, your immune system never learns how to not freak out over every small thing it encounters. And if it never learns that, then maybe you have more allergies when you get older. The problem with that is that there are some good reasons to think that that doesn't totally explain the increase in allergies in the U.S. I mean, for one thing, you have 50% of Americans who aren't allergic to anything. But when you go back and look at their childhoods, they haven't had any less hygienic childhood. You know, it's not like they were rolling around in the dirt, and so now they don't have allergies. And your mom kept you too clean as a kid, so now you do. There's just some people who have allergies and some people who don't, and more people who did in the past, and we don't know why.
Is it possibly a case where we're just better at diagnosing allergies and we would have just ignored it in the past, or are we really seeing an increase?
They do say that we are really seeing an increase.
Okay.
I'm sure that there is some element of, you know, we have more medications to treat this stuff now, so people pay attention to it more, and maybe you have something that you think is a cold, that is actually a cold, but you think is allergies, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you aren't actually going to the doctor and getting diagnosed. It's easy sometimes to mistake one thing for the other. But the experts do say we are seeing more people with more allergies.
Getting back to the hygiene hypothesis, is that being abandoned now, or are they trying to drill down finer and see if there's something more specific that we're overlooking?
That's certainly not being abandoned. It's something that does explain some things that we see, but just doesn't seem to explain everything. So what the scientists are really trying to do now is sort of try to figure out whether the hygiene hypothesis actually is an explainer of some of the things that are going on with allergens, but then also what else could be contributing to this? Because it seems like right now, you know, the hygiene hypothesis could be part of what's happening, but it's probably not the entirety of what's happening. So they need to kind of get more down into that data and figure out what else is there. Because, you know, you have things like, for instance, asthma is the same sort of response with, you know, the immunoglobulin and the mast cells and the histamines, just like we have with a runny nose, but it's just in a different place in your body. And asthma rates are actually going down as a whole throughout the U.S. and in other Western countries, but those countries haven't gotten any grubbier childhoods lately. Right. So meanwhile, you have small specific populations in those countries, like African Americans in the U.S. who live in poverty, where asthma rates are rising, but childhood hygiene hasn't really changed in those communities either. So there's clearly something else going on there beyond the hygiene hypothesis, and we just need to study this stuff more and figure out what that other thing is.
One other mystery you wrote about is placebos, maybe for some allergy sufferers, being effective. How would that work?
Well, it's kind of a weird thing is that, you know, experts tell me the placebos work really well to treat your allergies. So the placebo effect for allergies is around 20 to 40%, which is really, really high. Hmm. And it means that, so for instance, people taking Claritin, you experience a 46% improvement in symptoms. But in the same study, you have people who are taking the placebo who saw their symptoms improve by 35%.
Wow.
So, right, yeah. You know, so there's not much of a difference between the placebo and the actual drug. Part of that issue is probably the fact that, you know, this is qualitative symptoms, not quantitative symptoms. You know, nobody's sitting there measuring the amount of snot coming out of your nose. This is all like, do you feel better today? How did you feel? And that can get sort of messy when you actually start trying to quantify those qualitative ideas. But then another thing is also that, you know, the FDA does its studies on allergy medications using people who are already experiencing allergy symptoms. If you didn't do that, then you wouldn't necessarily know, you know, if you took a bunch of people who weren't already experiencing allergies and you started testing an allergy drug on them, well, you wouldn't know which ones it actually worked for and which ones just weren't going to get allergies to begin with. So there's a good reason they do that. But on the other hand, it means that it's hard to separate the effectiveness of the allergy drug from just the normal cycle of how a seasonal allergy works. You know, it peaks and then it falls off. And if you wait long enough, it's going to go away anyway. So there's a lot of confounding factors here, but there is still just this signal that, you know, to a certain extent, you can make yourself feel better by thinking that you should feel better, and whatever you happen to attach that to can't help.
Well, I'll try taking some placebos this season. Maggie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
That was Maggie Kurth-Baker. She's science editor at boingboing.net.
On Friday, U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb ordered county clerks in Wisconsin to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, but she also ordered a stay on her decision while an appeal on the case is pending.
WPR reporter Gilman Halstead has been covering this story for Wisconsin Public Radio. He's with us now for the latest. Gilman, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob.
So do we have that right? She says, yes, my ruling means you have to issue these licenses, but my stay means you don't for now.
Right. Right now, her ruling is basically not in effect. It is stayed. She said other things in the ruling, too, of course. Mm-hmm. She said not only should the licenses be issued, but that she ordered the governor to tell all the department heads under him to address all of the things in state statutes that affect the legal status of marriage to make sure that they were enforced equally for same-sex couples as they are for different-sex couples. But that also is on hold.
Mm-hmm. So in that week between the original ruling and then what she had to say on Friday, a lot of people got marriage licenses, or at least think they did. Did last Friday's ruling clarify where they are now?
No, it really didn't. Something's come up today that will possibly have some effect on what the legal status of those marriages are, but there's definitely a disagreement. The state attorney general, J.B. Van Hollen, has said that he believes those marriages are not legal, or they are at least uncertain in their legal status, whereas the ACLU says, as happened in Utah, that at least at some level they do have legal force when it comes to federal benefits that are available to married couples.
And you mentioned something happening today on this front.
Right. We have state congressional members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation who wrote to Eric Holder, U.S. Attorney General, and said, please do what you did in Utah, which is to step in and say very clearly that those people who got married in that window, there mm-hmm. was a similar one in Utah, that they are eligible for the benefits they get through Social Security. They can file taxes together, those sorts of things that are under federal law.
And now from the Attorney General Van Hollen, what's next for him now? He had appealed the original decision. Where is he now?
Well, he needs to appeal it again, basically reappeal it, the way I understand it. And I actually did talk to his office today, and they just haven't filed it yet. We'll be getting notice, I would guess, within the next couple of days of them actually just refiling that. Because initially, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago sort of bounced it back up to Judge Crabb, saying that they didn't believe it was appealable until she finally ruled.
And then you heard from Governor Walker today. What are people asking him? What did he have to say?
Well, he's been an outspoken supporter of the ban in the past and says that he has voted for it. And so he was asked again, as he was on Friday, whether he'd changed his mind. He would not respond directly to that. He just said, it doesn't matter. It's not a matter of me changing my mind. As the governor, I don't have a role in this. It's the other two legs of the government, mm-hmm. the legislature and the courts. And right now it's in the courts who have responsibility. And whatever happens, we'll follow what the court says at this point.
It's going to be a winding path. Do you know how long it's going to be before there's a final decision?
Well, I talked to an attorney today that said either the Wisconsin case or one of the others that are now a little bit further along in the appeals process in one of, I think it's at least five other states, mm-hmm. Similar rulings have taken place, will eventually go to the Supreme Court. Wisconsin's could, but it's likely to be the first one at the head of the line. And that could be before the court in their next session, which begins in October, so that by this time next year, it's possible.
We'll probably talk to you about this many times between now and then. Thanks to Gilman Halstead, WPR reporter, for bringing us up to date on same-sex marriage in the courts.
Our next guest spent more than three decades working for the Central Intelligence Agency. Starting at the bottom, Jack Devine would go on to become the agency's acting deputy director of operations, meaning he was in charge of all the CIA spying operations.
In a new memoir, he looks back at his time overseeing some of the nation's most pivotal covert operations, as well as peeling back some of the mystery surrounding the agency. And while some question the CIA's role in today's society, he says covert operations, as opposed to costly and devastating full-scale military interventions are the best safeguard of America's interests worldwide.
Jack Devine spent 32 years working for the CIA. He's currently the founding partner and president of the Arkin Group. He's the author of Good Hunting, an American Spymaster Story. And he joins us from Argo Studios in New York City. Jack, thanks so much for being with us today.
A pleasure to be here.
Well, you left the CIA and you're in the corporate intelligence business now, as you call it, but you couldn't stop turning over your years in the CIA. What do you think needs to be said or needed to be said for you before you could kind of move on?
Well, I'm not sure I could ever move on. And if you do an autopsy, you're going to find there's a piece of my heart that has the CIA seal. At least emotionally, I can't. And the book is driven basically from a reaction to a book that was written a few years ago saying that CIA is a rogue organization and covert action never works. And what I wanted to say is CIA is made up of public servants and people like your neighbors. And not only does covert action work, in the world that we're entering today, whether it's Syria, Ukraine, and Iraq or Afghanistan, we're not going to be putting troops on the ground and we're going to be looking at this traditional tool of statecraft more and more.
And as you said, you think that covert operations are more effective, more important to national interests than military, the military side of things, especially large-scale military maneuvers. Why is that?
Well, first of all, I would say that we have the finest military in the face of the earth, and our enemies understand that. I mean, I wouldn't worry about Putin or the terrorists not understanding how important that is. But I was in charge of the program to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan. And we did that without putting any troops on the ground. You have to have a fighting group. The indigenous people have to decide their future and they have to really want it. And I think that's a problem we're facing in Iraq. So where there is an indigenous people, we can support them. And where there isn't, then I suggest we not try to do nation building and put troops on the ground unless we are assaulted.
Now, you talked about one of the driving forces behind this book being your belief that rogue operations are not really a core part of the CIA. They don't happen very often. How did that idea about what happens in the CIA, the rogue agent, how did that idea persist?
Well, I think there's the romantic presentation of the CIA, which we can come back to later. I'm actually not uncomfortable with Hollywood on this point. The big concern, one of the really misunderstandings, I spent 32 years, but I also studied all of our covert action operations that preceded that. And I don't know of a single example, and I defy anybody to step forward and show me where there was a CIA operation that was not approved by the President of the United States. That's how tight the system is. And yet in the public mind, you know, we look to the CIA, and the truth of the matter is we usually have a policy problem. And again, the portrayal of the CIA as a rogue makes great movies, but poor history.
Well, there's so much that we could talk to you about. You spent 32 years in the CIA, so I want to kind of bounce around a little and touch on some different areas from your career. Among them, your take on the bin Laden capture, and you write that you weren't surprised that the U.S. captured and killed bin Laden in Pakistan, but you'd sort of expected it to happen about 10 years earlier. So how did that operation to catch bin Laden go astray, in your opinion?
Well, I actually misspoke. I hope I'm not today, but in December, you know, we had the 9/11 in September. And in December, I really was saying that, you know, before the winter comes, my guess is we would have our hands around bin Laden. I think there was and this is not a surprise, I remain baffled on why we went into Iraq. And I believe when you go to war, it just sucks so much energy and resources to war fighting that we reduced the emphasis on Afghanistan. And even there, we began to emphasize nation building in a country where I think I will be surprised if we don't run into similar problems as we're running into Iraq. So I knew we were going to get them. In fact, it's called good hunting because one of the core things about CIA is to hunt for bin Laden, hunt for Escobar, hunt for Kanzi. It's going after the mole in CIA. And it's an old slogan that we use among ourselves that go back, you know, to Kipling. And it's I often sign cables saying good hunting instead of break a leg or good luck.
You also talk about speaking truth to power. You consider that part of your job. Did you ever tell a sitting president we're getting off track here with Osama bin Laden?
I was gone at the time of 9/11, but I wrote what I thought was an important op-ed for saying that where is bin Laden? And this was about a year before the attack, and saying that he was basically on the lips and minds of the CIA and our special forces, but Washington wasn't paying enough attention. So that's just, you know, I'm not invited to the Oval Office and probably less likely today than ever. But it's the reason I pick up a pen, frankly, and it's to write op-eds. I had one on what I call the CIA solution, the Wall Street Journal, back in June or July of 2010, saying that, you know, we're going to face a problem in the end that we need to get out and leave behind CIA and special forces to try and maintain the best position we can. So I tried to make my voice heard, and I keep on, and that's why I'm on this wonderful radio program with you.
Well, we're talking right now with CIA veteran Jack Devine. He's written a new book about his 30-plus year career at the agency. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking with Jack Devine, author of Good Hunting, an American Spymaster story about his life and his career in covert operations for the CIA. And you can join the conversation with your questions for Jack at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we'll go to our callers now. We have Kyle with us from Oconomowoc. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. I wanted to ask him what he knew about the Iran-Contra scandal, and was he a part of it?
All right. Thank you. And Jack.
That's a good question. I actually go into it in some length in the book. It is the example of what I would call extremely poor covert action. And if you peel it apart, you start with the first point, that it was a presidential decision to make this transfer of TOW missiles to the Iranians. That was bad policy. And I was chief of the Iranian branch at the time. And I thought I had taken some initiatives to curtail that from happening. But the president did sign a finding, and we went forward with it. It was bad policy, but it wasn't illegal. What was illegal was that through the White House folks, they charged the Iranians double and sent half of the money to Central America to support the Contra effort there. That was in violation of the Boland Amendment, which broke the law. And that's what produced a huge scandal that almost brought down the Reagan administration. It was probably the lowest point in the administration. So it started with a backroom operation. And in the book, I go through what I consider good and bad covert action. And one of those things is you have to be consistent with American wishes, and you have to coordinate we don't like bureaucracies, but there's a purpose for it. You need to coordinate it so you don't have rogue operations. And this was a rogue operation, but it was a White House rogue operation supported by CIA.
So what else would you say it takes to have good covert operations?
Well, I think, you know, the Afghan program is a classic example of what I consider good covert action operation. American people were behind it. And I knew Charlie Wilson. I traveled with him, and we can talk about that. But it wasn't Charlie Wilson's war. It was a Republican president, Democratic Congress, if you can believe this, working together. You had a robustly funded program. You had experts, in the case of CIA, working with people on the ground that wanted to fight. And you put those combinations together, and you have the makings of good covert action, but not necessarily a good movie.
And you have said that Afghanistan looms especially large when you think back over your years, and some incredible stories out of that time. And I think among them, what you're talking about here, ousting the Soviet Union from Afghanistan. Can you tell us a little bit about the part that you played?
Excuse me. I think the major fact, I was in charge of the Afghan program. So in 85, not many people realized this, there was a lack of optimism about our prospects of prevailing in Afghanistan. But the administration made a decision to really give it one more big shot. So we tripled the amount of weapons and arms, and including things like mules that I needed to transport the weapons. And the last 1,000 miles, I guess, was handled by these 9,000 mules that we marched across China. But the key here was the Stinger missile. And it was the first American weapon, and it changed history in that it shot down the Hind helicopters. And that day, the Russians started flying higher. And then the weapons poured across the border, and back in Moscow, they decided to throw in the towel. Little by little, I think it undermined the morale of the Soviet Union, combined with the economic failures and the tremendous pressure coming from the Reagan administration in the defense area. They just couldn't pull up their socks one more time. And it was ideologically based, and it was, at the end of the day, a stale ideology. So the Stinger missile, the fight there, really was a major factor, and all these things coming together to bring in the Soviet Union.
What do you make about the aftermath of American operations in Afghanistan? Should the U.S., do you think, have stuck around Afghanistan afterward and invested in rebuilding the country?
Charlie Wilson and I had long discussions. I actually worked on some plans to do that, and he was convinced that, you know, we should throw money in. However, when I stand back after 25 years, I think I was wrong. I think if we had thrown the money in, it would have not made a bit of difference. The country wasn't ready for change, and it was such a tribal area that you were almost inevitably going to end up with the conflict that ended up with the Taliban coming to power. So with a longer view of things, I know that's a criticism, but I think when I look at it and my own evolution and thinking about it, I don't think it would have made a difference. And that's why I'm so pessimistic and have been for 10 years about Iraq, and it's why I'm pessimistic about Afghanistan today.
I'm going to go back to our phone lines now and take a call from Daniel in Minong. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Did the CIA believe Saddam had the infamous weapons of mass destruction that took us into the war in Iraq?
All right. Thank you, Daniel. Interesting question, and gets at some of the public relations problems that the CIA has had. What do you think?
Well, I think all of us, I don't know anybody, I've yet to meet anybody either in or out of government that didn't think that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. I think some of us thought there was less because there was an inspector program that did reduce some of the weapons of a fairly large amount of weapons of mass destruction, but it didn't explain where all they went. My problem wasn't whether or not they had weapons of mass destruction, and I don't think it really was fundamentally the CIA's problem, and I can talk about it in some length about how Saddam Hussein handled it. My problem was I didn't see anything that led to the immediacy of it. What was the urgency? What were we expecting? And I think at the time we were bogged down with the Taliban in Afghanistan, it was the wrong time to decide that something had to be done. I, to this day, as I said earlier, remain baffled. I don't understand why we had to, even if he had the weapons, move in. So it was the urgency that I have my biggest problem with.
And the intelligence came from a source named Curveball, that you dubbed Curveball, that was later discredited. And that kind of ricocheted back on the CIA. Looking back, would you have navigated those waters differently? Or was it just sort of outside of your purview?
Well, my experience with information, when you get such stunning information that you really have to go and kick the tires of the source. And in this case, it was a German source. And as I understand it, that reporting went and made its way into the president's briefing without that source having been met by a CIA official. When that source was met by a CIA official, he immediately decided that it was a fabricator. I worked with other directors where terrorist reports have come in, and they have insisted on getting to that source. So I think in retrospect, whenever the intelligence community puts its hands on a source that has sensational type of reporting that has to be dealt with force, someone has to sit down and go toe-to-toe with them, and I don't think, unfortunately, it happened in this case.
And, Jack, we've got less than a minute left here, but given how you write about the CIA, the time in it, you said the CIA is tattooed on your heart. Do you think that the agency gets the trust and maybe the affection that it deserves from the American people?
I've been surprised over the years when you step out of the beltway in Washington, how much support there is for it. And I said, when you look at the movies where we started at the beginning, Hollywood's characterization of it, at the end of the day, there's still a fascination with it. And it accrues to the agency's benefit. Not only do I not look like Sean Connery, but it enhances, how one's perceived and how the agency's perceived. So I'm not worried about how America feels about the CIA. And there are blips, and we should be held accountable for sure. But I think Americans do understand they need this capability and that the people in there are really public servants that aren't much different than their relatives.
Jack, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
That was CIA veteran Jack Devine. His new memoir is called Good Hunting, an American Spymaster Story.